You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Hey everyone, I'm so excited for today. This is going to be a fun and insightful interview. I am with Deb Gabor, who was born to brand. She is the founder and brand dominatrix, which we're going to get into, of Soul Marketing, a brand strategy consultancy obsessed with building winning brands. Since 2003, Soul Marketing team has led brand strategy engagements for organizations ranging from international household names like Dell, Microsoft, NBC Universal, to digital winners like Allrecipes, Cheeseburger, HomeAway, and RetailMeNot, and dozens of early stage tech and digital media titans. Through investor pitches, a division of Soul Marketing, hundreds of startup founders have benefited from Deb's wizardry for crafting pitches that entice investors to open their wallets to the tune of up to $85 million. Deb, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. So let's dig in and let's just start with, how did you become a brand dominatrix? Whoosh.
Well, like all dominatrices, that's the plural of dominatrix, correct?
Good to know.
Yes, like all dominatrices, I went to brand dominatrix school. No, actually, so that was a title that was bestowed upon me by a really awesome creative director that I worked with years and years and years ago when I first started my company. You know, he really admired the way that I came in. And while the creative team was sort of managing the creative process and trying to figure out how the brand was going to show up in the marketplace, I was kind of owning the strategy and the foundation of the brand in this just incredibly focused, laser sharp kind of way. And he always referred to me cracking the whip on the clients and cracking the whip on the creative team just to make sure that we were honoring the brand. And he said, you know, you're kind of like a dominatrix. So the title stuck. And so now it's not like I came up with that title for myself. I am the brand dominatrix and I totally own the metaphor. And then, you know, I love these goofy titles because I have a brand alchemist who works for me. I've got a marketing MacGyver. I've got a brand triloquist. I have, let's see, who else do we have? Our Lady of Operational Excellence. So I let people come up with their own titles. And, you know, technically I'm the CEO, but I'm in charge of everyone.
I love those titles. I'm going to have to come up with one for myself now. That's so good. I want to actually dig into something you said that I think is important for the people in our community in Launch Street. You know, the innovators out there, whether you're inside a company or you're an entrepreneur, to think about. You had talked about having laser sharp focus on branding and honoring the brand. Will you just talk a little bit before we delve into my other questions about why that's important? Because, you know, I come from actually a background of brand strategy and that's not my focus anymore by any means. It's innovation. But, you know, I've seen time and time again what watering down a brand can do and what not staying focused can to do. So when you said that, I just thought, oh, I want to hear her perspective on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I get up on my soapbox about this, especially when I'm working with early stage companies or companies that are really trying to reinvigorate their position in the marketplace and maybe capture some share that they've lost or enter new markets or, you know, launch a new product or something like that. They do need to behave like emerging brands. I always tell everybody, brand or be branded, because you have a brand whether you like it or not. If you're just starting out and you don't take ownership of the brand identity, which is the part of the brand construct that you actually own, you give it permission to let the audience sort of give the brand its life. And so if you let the audience control your brand and you let them own how your brand shows up in the marketplace and you let the audience own the foundations of that brand, then what happens is you set yourself up for having a broken brand promise. So here's an example. And I always like to use the example of the cable companies. So, you know, raise your hand if you have had a great relationship with your cable company over the years, right? Nobody ever says, I love my cable company, right?
Right.
This is an example of just the ultimate in the broken brand promise. I guarantee you that the cable company, and it like insert brand name here, I guarantee you that that cable company did not set out to have a brand that is designed to disappoint customers every time they get on the phone and call, because you have to navigate this very complicated interactive voice response system where every time you actually reach a human, you have to repeat your name and your address and your phone number and what your problem is, and you just get bounced around the company. I guarantee you that the cable company did not want to create a relationship with its customers where, you know, they give you an 8-hour window of time when potentially the technician is going to show up at your house. And when they do, they track mud through the house. And, you know, if it's a 8 o'clock appointment, they show up at 7:59, or, right, you know, if the range of time is like from 8 to 4, they show up at 3:59 in the afternoon, that kind of stuff. So that's an example of when you don't control how your brand lives in the hearts and minds of its customers, you let the hearts and minds of the customers take over ownership of the brand itself. So from the onset, I always say it's really important to build a foundation for that brand, because it gives you the gift of focus. What am I going to do? What am I not going to do? Like, who is the customer that I'm going to serve? Who is the customer who is most highly predictive of my success, which I think we're going to talk about a little bit later. And also, you know, it helps you really be a tiebreaker between some of those difficult competing priorities that you might have as an organization.
Do you think that sometimes companies, whether you're large or small, lose ownership of their brands because they don't take that brand strategy, which is so key, and move it past marketing into all the customer touch points? You know, like when I think, I'd love your cable example, because I just went through that, where literally 257. I was like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, but, for your like, they're going to show up between 12 and 4, yeah, or 12, yeah, and 3, right? And you're 257. Are you kidding me? Yes. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I have nothing else to do today. That sounds great. I would love to sit here all day and not quite start anything, because I'm not sure when you're showing up. But part of that makes me wonder if, you know, all of these touch points that your brand has, whether that's your email signature, your customer service, your people on the front lines, the way your retail is set up, you know, fill in the blank. Is that because that brand strategy is not taken, I don't know if it's not taken seriously or not infused across everything?
Oh, absolutely. I agree wholeheartedly that a brand is something that lives inside and outside of your company. And it's in 360 degrees. It's inside, it's outside. It's in the hearts and minds of the people who are delivering that brand experience, as, yeah, well as the people who are receiving it. You cannot separate what you do and how you deliver from how you show up as a brand. And I was in a session last Friday where I was with this very, very smart guy who heads up this organization called the Institute for the Future. And someday you should maybe have them on your show. They'd be, yeah, very interesting. But anyway, he's a futurist. And what he was talking about is that organizations are, they're shape-shifting organizations where we have sort of these classical structures of leadership that are very, very hierarchical. What we're getting now are distributed organizations where leadership and ownership in those organizations is being distributed too, where like leadership is going to come from sort of the fringes and the edges of the organization. It's going to become increasingly important for organizations to deliver on their brand, whether it's the person who is emptying the waste baskets in the office at night, or the person who's the front line who is answering the phone, or a salesperson, or you know, an associate, all the way up to the CEO. Branding is everyone's responsibility. And as organizations change in the way we connect to one another within those organizations, it's going to be harder and harder to preserve the brand experience as those organizations become more and more distributed.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that. In the innovation world, I see a lot of that as well. So innovation is mistakenly becoming siloed, because with the distribution of, you know, power and leadership and just the hierarchy of the organization changing, it's getting harder and harder to make sure you maintain that culture of innovation. And branding, it sounds like, is kind of in the same boat. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, times are changing. So how do you create a brand that withstands the fluctuations of the marketplace?
So I think you create a brand today the same way that you're going to create a brand 10, 15, 20 years into the future, and as we created brands 10, 20 years in the past. And that is by having a very, very solid foundation. So I always say that the best brands in the world are the ones that create deep, deep emotional bonds with their users. And that is not just for consumer brands. It's not just for luxury brands. It's for every kind of brand, the ones that really connect deeply with the people who are using them. There is no other area of business or products or services where people use the word love, right? The best brands in the world can engender these feelings of love. And so if you want to create a brand that's going to withstand the fluctuations of the marketplace, you have to really, really understand who is your customer and how do you bond with them deep, deep, deep in their hearts and burrow into their minds. And most importantly, become part of elevating their self-concept and helping those people who are using those brands tell the story that they want to tell about themselves to not only themselves, but the rest of the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally makes sense. And I have a little bit of a loaded question to follow up on that, or not loaded, maybe biased question is the right way to say it.
Sure.
You know, when you think about, so, you know, the pushback I sometimes get when I say things similar to that, you said it way better and have much more experience in this area. But, you know, I agree with you, right? You need that emotional connection. At the end of the day, it's humans buying. So give me some love so that, you know, I want to buy from you. The pushback I often hear or experience is, well, I'm a technical product. I'm in healthcare, which is functional. I'm in, you know, this non-sexy industry that's all about the tactical. Would you say that particularly in those industries, it's just as important as it is if you're a, you know, an alcohol or a clothing line where we, you know, automatically assume that's the case?
Oh my goodness. I would say that it's even more important. And this is where I get really provocative about this. I work a lot with technology brands. And when I say technology brands, like sort of deep, kind of the core plumbing for the internet types of technology and computers and systems and servers, blade servers and workstations and things like that. And this is the argument that I get from them all the time. So these are very, very commoditized industries. Not that they are commodities, but they're very commoditized in terms of the functional benefits that they bring to the table. These companies basically all make the same crap, right? A computer is a computer is a computer is a computer. Yeah. A workstation is a workstation is a workstation. You know what I'm saying here. Like the functional benefits of what this stuff does is all the same. To differentiate yourself on the basis of bells and whistles alone, faster, better, cheaper, thinner, bigger, smaller, whatever, or what I call the itties, reliability, availability, scalability, manageability, anything that ends in ITY, like go look at any tech company's website, you will see all of those words all over the place. It is not differentiating. It is a sea of sameness. The companies that are going to emerge as winners in B2B markets are the ones who know who is the human, who is the human being in the organization who is making the decision on this purchase. What is the story that she or he is trying to tell about his or her life? How is he or she wanting to be the hero in that story? And how does this particular product and the way we deliver that product and the relationship that we have with that person based on that product, how does that make them the hero? And ultimately, what does it say about them that they make a decision to buy IBM or they make a decision to buy Dell or they make a decision to buy Apple or Microsoft or whatever? And so I think it's increasingly important in B2B markets to really identify who that core buyer is and bring some humanity into the brand. And, you know, that emotional bond, it goes far beyond just making people feel good, because 98% of what happens in your brain with regard to a buying decision happens outside of the part of your brain that makes you aware of things. So like 98% of those buying decisions happen outside the neocortex. They're happening deep, deep, deep in the limbic system, right? And so everybody needs that. And so people buy things from people. That's the message.
I love the ability thing. I always talk about the trap. It's like better, smaller, faster. It's simply not enough.
Yep.
Because it's just, it's someone can outbetter you tomorrow.
Absolutely.
They can out, you know, functionality you tomorrow.
Yeah, I started my career, it seems like a million years ago, but I started my career in technology marketing. Like I worked for AT&T Bell Labs. There were Nobel Prize winners that were walking up and down the hallways of the buildings that I worked in at the beginning of my career. And what I learned about marketing then, and this goes back a pretty long time because I'm grown up. what I learned then was, like, if you're trying to sell a better mousetrap, it's not all about selling a trap that has a bigger platform or it has a tighter spring or it has like a bigger, it has a bigger functioning, you know, part of the thing. Sometimes selling a better mousetrap is finding people for whom mice are actually a problem, because some people don't think mice are a problem. right?
Yeah. Well, you can't sell them something better if they don't need it.
Exactly. And so that speaks to this, like that whole issue of the ERs, the ERs, and the itties. So, you know, I talk about the itties all the time, but the ERs, it's the same thing. And so, you know, you cannot create a sustainable brand that's going to be around for the long haul if all you're differentiating yourself on are bells and whistles or features and options that are going to be standard equipment tomorrow.
Yeah, it's funny that those things that you think differentiate you, that quote unquote better functionality, becomes cost of entry.
Yes,
everybody then starts to do it. It just doesn't, you know, and I love talking about this, a little bit of an offshoot, but Dollar Shave Club, because the blades are not better. It's not like I subscribed to Dollar Shave Club because I was in the grocery store going, you know, my legs are just always stubbly. Like with 10 blades in the grocery store, I just can't solve this problem. I need a better blade. So that's not why I went over there, right? I went there because I was like, I'm sick and tired of all this a little bit better incremental crap. So I'm going over here to something totally different. So I want to flip it a little bit. What are some of the biggest mistakes brands make that put them on the path to irrelevancy?
So one of those I call fatal conceit. And that is the idea. And this is, I see this a lot. I work a lot with startups, you know, in my investor pitches business. I see a lot of, there's no one else out there who's doing exactly what we do, which really speaks to, you know, what you're saying about Dollar Shave Club, right? There are lots of different ways to get your legs shaved, right?
Yep.
The functional benefits of what you provide, there is always a choice to do something else. There's always a choice to do nothing. It is fatal to be so conceited that you think that there's no one else out there who can deliver the same benefits that you can. And I think that that's really one of the biggest mistakes. Another mistake that I see is just diluting the brand by having the brand show up in different ways to different audiences where there's a lot of confusion. This seems like a really basic thing, and this is like brand management 101, but you need a singular, consistent message that cuts through all the BS and actually speaks to your ideal customer, the customer who is most highly predictive of your success, the one who is going to be the most profitable for you, and focus all of your energy on the ones that are going to help you win with messages that are going to help them win. So I see a lot of just brand dilution. And then I see a lot of brands that are totally asleep at the wheel, right?
Right.
The ones, and you know, you're all about innovation, so you know about this, like the great innovations are coming from the periphery, right?
Yeah.
They're coming from where you least expect them. The great innovations are not coming at you head on from a direct competitor. They're coming from outside your market. They're coming from outside your category. These innovations may not be visible to you. You may just get clues about them just from behaviors and shifts that are going on in the marketplace. And it's a huge mistake to not pay attention to what's in front of you. And so, you know, like Kodak, for instance, like Kodak totally missed out on that whole digital camera thing, didn't they?
Oh my gosh, come and go. You know what's funny about, I have a slide when I keynote, it's like Kodak, Blockbuster, Sears, and half of the people in the audience, if they're, you know, younger, I'm a Gen Xer, so younger than me, are like, what are those color blocks?
Right.
On your screen, like they don't even know what they are. And I'm thinking, my God, these were icons.
Yeah, they were
business.
Iconic brands when we were growing up. And I imagine you and I are contemporaries for each other, you know, like Kodak and, you know, other ones that I think about, Xerox, for instance, you know, Xerox, like they would have been very, very well positioned to kind of own the document-free, paper-free revolution in offices because they were already there. Like they were already in everybody's freaking office, and we called it by the brand name. When you made a photocopy of something or you shared a document with somebody, you made a Xerox. Like they were very well poised. They were really entrenched and ready to go with that, but they totally missed that whole revolution. Kodak asleep at the wheel, Blockbuster asleep at the wheel, BlackBerry asleep at the wheel. So, you know, these are, I think that not paying attention to where disruptions are going to come from and listening to the cues that come from the marketplace are going to be the death of brands because they're no longer going to stay relevant. So the brands that have a role in relevance that is about solving acknowledged problems for folks in novel ways, but also bond with people to create these conditions of irrational loyalty, those are the ones who are going to have the staying power because they're going to be able to reinvent themselves over and over and over again in terms of how they deliver on their promise, but the promise never changes.
So let's dig into the customer a little bit, because I think you just used a phrase, am I getting it right, irrational loyalty, which I think is so cool, that idea that it's above. And I've got a few things that I am totally loyal to that way that I know are totally irrational. But if you ask me about it, I will not venture away from them, period. Uh-huh. Like, they are my heart and soul. It's kind of crazy that how that works. So, but that really is because they figured out, right, that I'm their ideal customer. So yeah. How do you, you talk about the unicorn customer, the ideal customer archetype. How do you figure that out to that level where you get to a rational loyalty? Because that's beyond having, you know, a quote unquote customer. That's having a tribe. That's having like people in your community.
Oh, absolutely. And I love how you call it a tribe. And I'm seeing more and more that brands are organizing around their tribes. And that really does speak to both this sort of ideal customer archetype as well as the concept of irrational loyalty. Let me talk first about what I mean by irrational loyalty, and then we'll back up and we can talk about the ideal customer and how those two things fit together. So when I talk about irrational loyalty, I'm talking about the brands that you are so in love with and you love so unconditionally that if you were to use something else, you would feel like you were cheating on that brand.
Yeah. I have a few.
Right. Okay. We all have a couple of these. And, you know, anytime you say like, I'm a Mac, not a PC, or I'm a Coke person, yeah, not a Pepsi person, or even, you know, more profoundly, like I'm an iThingy person through and through, like I'm an iPhone person. I actually judge people harshly when they're not using an iOS device, right?
Well, they're obviously not cool and innovative, that I can tell you.
Exactly. And so the condition of irrational loyalty looks like this. That is, when I know rationally that there are other choices that are either more available, they're higher performance, they're a better value, they're more durable, maybe they're smaller, they fit in my pocket better, et cetera, et cetera. And yet I still, time after time after time, will choose this other brand because I like what this other brand says about me as a human being and how it elevates my self-concept and gets me closer to self-actualization and makes me my highest, best performing, best self. I will go to that brand time and time again. Another example I use is Zappos, which is a brand, yeah, that I love, just because I love the idea of going online, selecting, usually when I order shoes from Zappos, I order them like three or four pair at a time. They come to my house, I can try them on in the privacy of my own home, in the good lighting of my closet and dressing room area with my outfits and things like that. Invariably, I end up keeping more pair of shoes when they come by mail. And then also Zappos has made it frictionless for me to shop at home, right? Versus there's a Nordstrom literally right down the street from me. I could walk into Nordstrom today. They have an amazing shoe selection. I could select shoes and I could wear them home tonight, right? However, I so much prefer the experience of shopping at Zappos and everything about them. They have branded love. If Zappos sold farm implements and I was running a ranch, I would probably buy the farm implements from Zappos. That's how irrationally loyal I am to the brand. So that's what we mean by irrational loyalty. When you know that there's other stuff that just works better and would serve you better, and in your heart of hearts, you know that there's another way, but you just can't break up with this one thing, that's irrational loyalty. That is the best place to be, right?
Yeah, it's fantastic. And, you know, I think you can, with that, particularly the example of Zappos, is a great example of, I can get everything on Amazon, but better, slightly faster, any of that doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is how Zappos speaks to me. So same with the phone. I mean, my husband has a Samsung, which I scoff at every time he pulls it out of my closet. It's not an iPhone. I mean, it's just embarrassing.
For shame.
How could I be married to you? You, gosh, it's embarrassing. But, you know, but there are some real benefits to his phone. Functionally, I get it. Like, I really do. But the other little part of me goes, loser.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's an interesting thing because the brands that you use become part of the person that you are. The brands that you use, they don't just say stuff about you, they become part of you. And so that's irrational loyalty. And so the brands that are successful in engendering this irrational loyalty, they are doing that among what you mentioned before, their ideal customer. And what I mean by an ideal customer is that it is an archetype. The ideal customer archetype is kind of this amalgamation of all of the best qualities of the best customer, that singular customer who the brand is built for. And so, yes, there are different segments. Like, I'm not the target audience for the iPhone. I mean, middle-aged women are not the core target audience for the iPhone. Apple gets us just by virtue of the fact that they make a really freaking cool product that we want to carry and we like, but we're not their ideal customer. Their ideal customer is actually a guy between the ages of 18 and 34, yeah. Right? And so they built the brand for that person. And so what we mean by the ideal customer, again, it's an archetype. It doesn't really exist in real life. Maybe it does. I mean, a lot of times in business-to-business settings, we can talk about an ideal customer because the companies that I work with, they're like, oh yeah, it's a client just like so-and-so, or it's this company like so-and-so that we just worked with, and they're exactly perfect because A, they're the most profitable to serve. B, you're the proudest and most excited to represent them and sell to them and be with them and get in bed with them, right? And C, they're buying the stuff that you're laying down. And it's a profile of the singular customer that if you maybe only had like 20% of all of your customer base were this ideal customer, you would be wildly successful. So that's what we mean by that ideal customer. But the idea is to profile them beyond just demographics and firmographics. So it's not just, you know, like Apple, it's this guy, he's between the ages of 18 and 34. Well, also there's the psychographic, attitudinal, behavior dimensions to that, which are things like, you know, he's probably upwardly mobile in his career. You know, he values form over function. You know, he's a pace setter in his group. He's probably an influencer among his peers. He has an extreme desire and need to be connected to other people, you know, 24 hours a day and be seen as a person who's kind of leading the conversation. So that's an example of, you know, sort of adding those psychographic and behavioral attributes to a profile so that you can really, really picture who this person is. So you build your brand for that person and you market to the various segments.
So this is going to sound like a naive question, but I want to dig into it, especially, you know, we have so many innovators who are trying to launch new products and services, you know, like I said, both kind of individually and within large companies. How do you figure that out? So let's say you know the demographics, right? The basics. It's a woman in her 30s who's, you know, middle management. But how do you get to that deeper layer out of the gate?
So there's a couple of ways. If you're an organization that has some budget and the wherewithal to actually go out and study your customers, I recommend that you put a lot of effort and resource and budget into going out and looking at customers in the wild. And you can do that formally, you can do that informally, but we learn so much in my business, in my day-to-day work, we learn so much from actually going out and having conversations with customers, whether that's through quantitative surveys, or that's through observing them in social media, or that's engaging with them in qualitative research manner. Seeing their body language, hearing their words, seeing the whites of their eyes, talking to them, and asking them the questions that they've never been asked. Things like, you know, what are your needs in this particular area, and where are your needs currently being met, and what are you not getting, and what do you want a brand to do for you? And in an ideal state, if you were going to have an X that does Y, how would you want that to make you feel? And how would that propel you to your own success in your life? And, you know, what do you want it to say about you when you use a particular brand? Like, all these, they sound like nutty questions, don't they?
Yeah, but I think that, I mean, what I love about what you're saying is it really is about getting out there and connecting with the people that you think are your customer. And you're not always right. So it's good to delve and to understand them and have that connection. And I think if you're sitting in an office, getting out of that and getting into their world helps you make a lot of decisions better and more in a more meaningful way. And, you know, so in innovation, we do a ton of research, and I'm a big fan of it being simply part of the business, not a point in time exercise. So for my business, we're always out there talking to people. We're always getting feedback.
Oh yeah. Having that always on relationship with your customers where you're always getting feedback from them. Or, you know what? I think this also fits with new companies and new organizations or spinoffs or entrepreneurship and things like that. You need to be talking to people all the time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it should be part of your business strategy and plan all the time. And so we spend a lot of time doing ethnographies. And as you were talking about that, it reminded me of one in particular that I went to. It was for General Mills. We were making cereal portables a couple years ago now. And we recruited people that said they were healthy. We wanted people who healthy was important, which, you know, you laugh because, right, it's funny because people's definition of health is so varied.
Oh, but my God. I've done tons of work in the food space. Yeah.
It's so much fun, right?
Yeah,
so
awesome. Yeah.
And this woman, we're in her house and she's telling us about how she's health is a priority. And, you know, we open up her fridge and it's all Gatorade. And then, you know, there's a deep fryer on the counter and she's pouring sugar on her Cheerios as she's talking about how she's made these healthy changes. And, you know, I had to remind myself, she's not lying. That's how she lives. It's relative to her and how she lives. And that's her definition of health and how important it is for us as the people behind the brand to understand what people really mean when they say these things versus, and what really the actions and the non-actions that happen in their world. I'm sure we could have a whole conversation just about some of the things we've seen in people's worlds.
Oh yeah. And I love ethnography. I mean, that's absolutely the ultimate. We do online ethnographies all the time. The last time I did an ethnography where I actually, you know, was out in nature observing the gorillas in their natural habitat, I did a similar project to yours where I went to people's homes and I watched them during the dinner hour. I sat around during the chaos of cooking dinner and interacting with their families and trying to get a meal on the table. And this was way back when I first started working with a company called All Recipes, which is, I believe that they're probably still one of the world's largest online destinations for food-related content. And when I first started working with them way back in about 2006, when they had just been acquired by Reader's Digest Corporation, they were like the Craigslist of recipes. They, you know, sort of a bad user experience. And, you know, it was just user-generated recipes that were submitted. They weren't vetted. They weren't tested. And they all sort of like lived in this big database. Well, you know, a very, very smart CEO came into that company and 6 months later said, hey, you know what? We have an opportunity here. We need to be a brand and we need to be meaningful to some people. We need to find out who those people are and we need to find out how we're meaningful. And so this was at a time where there were a lot of these great online digital food brands that were emerging, like Epicurious and, you know, Cooks Illustrated and Food TV, you know, so foodtv.com, Food Network, whatever, you know, these were big brands in the digital media space, specifically in food. And so All Recipes was really trying to figure out, like, what is our unique role? So they sent me and my team to people's homes to watch what was going on while people were actually trying to cook meals. What we learned was that the definition of home cooking spanned a lot of different definitions, right?
From scratch.
Yeah. Their original assumption was All Recipes is for people who cook every single thing that comes to the table exclusively from scratch using original ingredients. Well, what we learned was home cooking is everything from I stood in front of the stove and it was on to I cook a Thanksgiving meal every night. But the thing that sort of bonded folks together, regardless of their cooking prowess, was their desire for a sense of accomplishment in the kitchen. Yeah. The question was, how do you make these people a hero? How you make them a hero is helping them win dinner. How do you make someone a dinner time hero on Wednesday night? Like, what's for dinner Wednesday night? And that was the unique role that they carved out. That guided everything they did from then on out. Every product they developed, every message they put into the market, every change and enhancement they made to the site, every interaction they had with a customer was through the filter of how do we solve the problem of what's for dinner Wednesday night? And it's very empowering to a company.
That's so insightful. And I want to take a deep breath for those listening out there to say what Deb is saying here is incredibly important about truly understanding who you serve, because that is the way to be meaningful. Let's go back to the dominatrix part of it and sex.
Okay.
So I'm going to do that sound effect every time I say dominatrix. It feels right.
We should have hired like a Foley operator for this.
Totally. How is branding like sex? And you said a few things in a couple of answers ago that I was like, oh, I bet that's part of it. but dig into that a little bit.
Okay. Well, how graphic can I be?
You can be as graphic as you want to be.
Okay. All right. Great. So where this came from is is from my own practice as a brander over the last however many years. Like going into places and pontificating and proliferating the message of branding and why brander be branded, et cetera. And looking at a lot of people who with these like glazed over expressions, right?
Yeah.
And I found that I could open up a lot of creative and strategic territory for people by just asking this question. All right. Really breaking branding all the way down past all this strategic stuff and all this emotional bond stuff and whatever, just by asking the question and answering the question, how does this product, service, company, brand, et cetera, how does this get your customer laid? That sort of like opened up everybody's mind. So the best brands in the world, I think I said this before, the best brands in the world are the ones who, you know, really bond deeply emotionally with other people. The best brands in the world are the ones who can give their customers kind of the simulated feeling of a toe-curling, mind-blowing orgasm. And what I mean by that, I mean, that's a very, very graphic description of that feeling. But the idea there is, remember I said that the best brands can elevate a person's self-concept and make them feel like they're on top of the world. Whether you feel like you're on top of the world, you got the world by the balls or whatever, when you feel at your absolute best, you want to grab the sexiest person next to you and you want to take a roll in the hay with them. Right? When you feel at your absolute best, that you are at the top of your game and you feel really, really, really sexy. You feel hot and you feel like you want to do it. And so really it is as basic as when you get stuck, customers get stuck. When I work with customers, like, I don't understand this. Why is this important? We clear the table. I look them right in the eye and I say, all right, close your eyes. I want you to picture the last time you had one of these really great orgasms. Who were you with? What were you doing? What was going on at the time? Was there music playing? Were you drinking? Were you in a bed? Were you in the bed of a truck? You know, what was going on there?
So backseat of a taxi, whatever works.
Yeah. I mean, it's an emotional exercise in recalling these really, really great feelings when you can completely let yourself go by recalling those feelings and basically recreating those feelings in those situations for yourself. You can kind of simulate the emotional connection that every brand should strive for. And I'm telling you, every IT manager wants to get laid. Every procurement manager in a big or small company wants to get laid. Every consumer wants to get laid. Everyone wants to get laid. I gotta say it. So that's how branding is like sex.
I love it. So I was just thinking as you were talking of, you know, we always talk about how do we add more value? How do we, you know, be high impact for our customers? But I love the idea of just switching even our internal language to say, how do we give our customers an orgasm?
Yeah.
How do we, in everything that we do, how do we make it so damn orgasmic that they cannot, like, they love it. It is just the best thing they've ever seen. So how do, and maybe you have some examples here, some of the best brands get their customers laid.
Yeah. So we talked about some of those brands, but then there are also brands that, like, maybe you don't even think of. One of the brands that I work extensively with is Dell. And I work with them exclusively on the side of their business where they sell computer shit to businesses. Oops. Can I say that? I'm sorry.
Oh yeah.
All right.
Beep.
Okay. All right. Bleep that out. Sorry about that. So I work with them on that part of their business, which on the surface seems like it's really, really boring, right? And they actually do a very, very good job of narrowing the field to the ideal customer being this IT manager who is trying to create a story for his or her life where he or she is the protagonist. And they message to them in a way that helps them picture their life full of success when they've achieved their goals in business and in IT, you know, using Dell products to support that. Does that answer the question pretty well?
No, it does. And I'm glad with kind of, I'm glad. I don't know who says glad anymore. How old am I? I think it's an interesting answer and important for people to pay attention to who are listening, because it doesn't have to be, what I hear you saying is it doesn't in any way whatsoever need to be the quote unquote sexy products that we think about, like the Harley Davidsons, the
exactly.
Apple, right? Like even in the most mundane of it, or the industries that we think of as, you know, the opposite of all that, that is just as important and just as possible.
Exactly. And that's why I like to use those kinds of examples, because I think that that's where people really struggle. They really struggle with, it's really easy to talk about how Tesla gets its customers laid, right?
Of course. Yeah.
And it's easy to talk about how Nike gets its customers laid and how Victoria's Secret gets its customers laid and all that kind of stuff. It's harder to talk about how does the phone company get customers laid, and how does this big behemoth computer manufacturer get customers laid, or this enterprise software company like an Oracle or somebody like that. How they get their customers laid is by really identifying, like, what is the story that customer is trying to tell for their lives? And the story that they're trying to tell for their lives is probably around all the RASM and ITTY stuff, like reliability, availability, yeah, scalability, manageability. But more likely, if you're talking specifically, like, I always go to the enterprise IT manager and, you know, in some kind of commercial operation, because I'm very, very familiar with that buyer. You know, for them, the story is, I want to go home and be home eating dinner with my family by 6:30 tonight. I don't want to get any phone calls from the head of whatever department who can't get on his freaking email this evening. I want to take a vacation this year for a week and have that entire time be completely uninterrupted. And then when I get back to work, I want to be asked about my opinion for where the future of enterprise computing is going, so that I can weigh in on what our infrastructure strategy needs to be for the next year. That's the story that I, as an IT leader, am trying to tell for my life. Now, as an IT product, you know, how do I help that IT leader tell the story? It's harder to connect the dots because it doesn't seem sexy, but I'll tell you, if that guy comes home for dinner and is sitting down to dinner at 6:30 with his family and makes it all the way through the dinner hour and is there to clean up the dishes and put the kids to bed, he's getting laid. He is getting laid.
That's a good evening for that guy.
Right.
That is for sure.
Right. Yeah.
So let's bring it down to a focus level. What are the three essential brand questions your brand must be able to answer?
Well, this is easy. Once you've identified who your ideal customer is, so, you know, asking yourself all those questions, like, who is that customer who is most highly predictive of our success that we're going to build this brand for? You have to answer these three questions. The first one is, what does it say about that person that they choose this brand? Mm-hmm. So that goes into the self-expressive benefits, the whole, like, you know, what is it that is becoming part of this person's self-concept and elevating their self-concept? The second question, which is the hardest question to answer, is, how do we make ourselves indispensable to that person? And how do you deliver indispensability? That is by being singular. So what is the singular thing that we bring to the table that they cannot get anywhere else? Very difficult question to answer, because this is the thing that is all about differentiation. And it's not just differentiation for differentiation's sake. It is meaningful differentiation. So what is the singular thing that somebody gets from working with us or buying from us that they can't get from anywhere else? This is the stuff that makes a Mazda and not a Mercedes-Benz. It is really difficult to describe, and it is not made up of features.
Well, and I bet you sometimes it's uncomfortable, because in answering that, you realize you don't have an answer and you need to work on it.
Exactly. And that's why I make a lot of money doing what I do. But seriously, like, digging in and being able to answer that question is very important. And this is the area that I see organizations struggling with all the time. You know, for my own company, I have to think about, like, what is the singular thing that you get from working with us that you don't get anywhere else? Well, yeah, you get me, right? But, like, I can't be anywhere, I can't be everywhere, because I can't multiply myself and clone myself. What you get is, like, you get this kind of driven, plain talking push to win in your marketplace that you're not going to get from any other brand strategy firm. You know, I'm going to call bullshit on you. My people are going to call bullshit on you. And we only work with organizations who have to make a big win. So what you get is the organization who has values and beliefs that, And then the third question really is, and we talked about this just a few minutes ago, the third question is really about, you know, how do you make your customer a hero in his or her own story? This is where we go all the way back to where we started this conversation, brand or be branded. Your customers own your brand. Your brand is about them, not about you. So you need to know the story for their life. What is the story that they're trying to create? And ultimately, how do you help them prevail in that story? So if you take the answer to those three questions, what does it say about a person? What's the singular thing you get here you can't get anywhere else? And then how do you make a person a hero? You add that all up. That's how you get the customer laid.
Oh, woo! My toes just curled.
Good.
I love the simplicity yet challenge of those questions. And I would encourage the people out there to write them down and actually go through the exercise and see where you are. Because I'm guessing, Deb, with the work that you do, and you work with, you know, big companies, you work with startups, you've done some really impressive stuff, but where you start and where you end up are drastically different.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is looking at branding in this way, just taking the frame and turning it on its side and being about customers instead of being about yourself, it really changes everything, and it can open up new territories for your brand in really incredible ways. And so if you're skeptical, if you're listening to this and you're skeptical and you're like, all right, all this stuff that Deb's talking about, getting people laid and making them heroes and stuff like that, that's just total bullshit. I challenge you to just do those four things. The first thing being create a profile of that archetypal perfect customer, and then answer those three questions for that customer and really dig in and see if you have a brand there. And if you don't, work on answering those questions, because that's where the brand DNA lives, is in the answer to those questions.
It's awesome. So you mentioned your team calling BS. What's the BS test? And so what is that all about? How do I know if I failed? I'm almost nervous to ask.
So this is really about that second question. You know, what is the singular thing that you get from me that you can't get anywhere else? You know, what do you get from our brand that is truly singular to us and about meaningful differentiation? The BS test is to ask yourself as you answer that question, what is the singular thing you can get here that no one else can imitate? The BS test is that true? And keep asking yourself, is that true? And until you get to an answer of yes, it's BS. And so that's what we mean by the BS test. That's the reason why organizations struggle so much with this issue of meaningful differentiation. Sure, you can hire another brand strategist. We all have our shtick. And we're all, you know, we all want to be the smartest person in the room. And we've all, you know, we all have the proven track record. And we all, we have the methodologies and all that kind of stuff and whatever. But the singular thing that you get from working with my team is this, just like this relentless pursuit of winning. And unless you come with a big problem that you have everything at stake to solve and you need someone who is going to push you to solve it, you don't work with us. And so that is truly the essence of singularity. So the BS test is, you know, can I really claim this as something that no one else owns? And it's very hard to articulate. It's really, really hard to uncover for the brand. And you have to keep asking. That's why it's not the itties or the errs. That's why it's the sort of core essence or the core DNA of the brand, the way you deliver the brand, the way people experience the brand, and what they're able to do with the brand, that indispensability that they can't get anywhere else. Like this is the stuff that creates that irrational loyalty.
So I'm curious, when clients call you, are they in a specific pain point, like, you know, the competition has swept in and is doing something that's taken their market share, or, you know, a new technology has come out that's made them, I don't know if irrelevant, but, you know, it's not as shiny and new, or, you know, I need to get money, or the startup is not moving forward? Are there specific pain points that you can call out to say, this is typically when they're calling because that's when their hunger to win is big enough?
Yeah. So all of those things that you just mentioned, and then other things that are maybe a little bit more subtle, which are things like, you know, this is really interesting. We've been in market for a really, really long time, and we're finding that we're having a difficult time connecting with customers in the sales process. You know, that would be one. Like, I don't understand why our sales messaging is not resonating with customers. That, you know, that's something. Another one is, we see a threat is imminent in our marketplace, and we need to be prepared for it. So a really good example would be I work with an online grocer on the East Coast that over the past couple of years saw the food procurement space change drastically. Everything from bicycle messengers delivering food to Uber Eats to a variety of different food delivery options to meal kits to, you know, like Blue Apron and HelloFresh and all that kind of stuff. Basically, the entire landscape of food procurement.
Drastically, yeah.
Yeah. And they were afraid that they were going to be asleep at the wheel because they didn't have an express delivery model. And so that would be like a specific pain point where they see that there's a threat coming. And one of the things that we're able to help them do is like when they see that there's a threat coming and they perceive that that threat is coming from their immediate industry, the good news is by going out and actually talking to customers, we can find out where those threats are coming from that are outside their industry, right? Where those customers are currently getting their needs met that maybe are not even on that company's radar. So other places that are, you know, sort of the triggers for those deep existential questions of business, as I like to call them, new leadership, acquisition, spinoff, investment, startup, entering new markets. All of those places are where there is pain around branding.
You know, I want to kind of loop this all together by saying that, you know, since our focus over here is business and innovation, I think when you have new innovations you're bringing to market, whether that's a product, a service, it doesn't matter to me. It's all the same. It's something someone will hopefully open up their wallets and buy from you. Is this branding becomes so critical because when you're trying to do something disruptive and new, you've got to be so solid and so consistent and so sexy. So get your customers laid in the marketplace to really make the impact you want to make, particularly when you're charting new territory. So, you know, it's part of the reason why I was excited to have you on, because I think it's true in general, extremely true. And when you're dealing with doing something innovative, you've really got to put a stake in the ground around branding.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, branding is something that doesn't take place at one single point in time. I always tell people that branding is this always on activity, that just to take it all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, when you asked about delivering the brand kind of through every fiber of the organization with every person and every function in the organization, you always have to be thinking about branding. And when people ask me like, when should I brand? I always say always.
Yeah.
And often, you know, it's just an ongoing activity.
Yeah, it's funny. We were looking at business cards earlier, which people, I think, often just get done. And we really labored over, is this our brand? Because it's a touch point, just like every other touch point, you know, that we have out there, whether that's me on stage or going to our online program or, you know, for you, whether they're hiring you or going to your website or listening to you here, it's all part of the brand. So, Deb, where can people go to connect with you and discover more?
So they can go to brandingissex.com if you want to learn all about this book and how to get the book. And most importantly, you can download a free chapter there. It's the chapter about the brand values pyramid, which we didn't talk about, but it's kind of the core methodology. But I'm giving it away for free. You could go to our company webpage, which is Soul Marketing, S-O-L, soul like the sun in Spanish. That's another story for another day, how I ended up with a brand that has the abbreviation for shit out of luck. As a branding expert, that's a really good story. Or you can find me on Twitter. I'm @Deb_Soul. Or, you know, you can email me. I'm Deb@soulmarketing.com. And I love to hear from people. Come tell me your brand story or ask me your deep existential question. Or, you know what I really like? Come and get into it with me, because I like to talk about these things and I like to be provoked, because it just makes my thinking better.
So we will, just so you know too, we'll put all of those links in the show notes too, so people don't have to try to write them down or remember them. So we will have them for everybody. And yeah, we didn't get into the brand values pyramid, but maybe we can have you back just to talk specifically. There were so many places to dig and get in bed together that I felt, you know, couldn't cover it all. But what's one thing, this is my last question for you, what's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
I think that people would be surprised to learn about me that I am an extreme skier.
Oh, are you?
Yes. And I'm obsessed with all things snow and mountains and things like that. So I think people would be surprised about that.
Wait, where are you located? Are you not in Colorado?
I am not. I wish I were in Colorado. Yeah. I'm located in Austin, Texas, but I do have
Austin. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of great skiing here in the central Texas area, especially today when it's 92 degrees. I think we're setting a heat record for this time of year, but I have a vacation home in Utah and I try to spend as much time there as I can, but I love my work so much. So I don't get a chance to do the skiing as much as I would like to, but I think that that's a surprising fact about me.
That is surprising. Well, here in Colorado, it is snowing today. So there you go. I know.
Right.
It's the opposite of 90 degrees. Deb, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to having you back at some point.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.